She has Hashimoto's, and she's dealing with weight gain and many digestive issues. Her bowels often fluctuated from days of constipation to then a day of diarrhea, and she was always gassy, bloated, and just uncomfortable. Her body felt inflamed all over. When I met Beth in my Hashimoto's program, she was in the weeds of daunting research about the Hashimoto's gut connection and was feeling overwhelmed without knowing where to start. She came with the diagnosis of hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, and IBS, but none of her providers ever connected things for her or guided her on how to work with all of these together. Instead, she was given medicine for the IBS, medicine for her thyroid, and she was told that there's actually nothing at all that she could do for Hashimoto's itself. And so she was left to put it all together on her own. Boy, was she in for a pleasant surprise when she joined the program and saw that she didn't have to do it all alone. She knew exactly where to start so that we can get to the bottom of her health mystery.
Every year, thousands of people are told there's no explanation for their health concerns and no way to fix them. They feel frustrated, undermined, and lost. I know, because that was me before I figured out the actual causes and reclaimed my health. Now, I help others do the same. I'm Ina Toppler, and this is Health Mystery Solved.
We just heard about Beth's struggles. Joining me on the show today to talk much more about this is Josh Deck. He's an ex-paramedic and a holistic nutritionist, and he specializes in gut health. He's also the host of the Reversible podcast, and he's a medical lecturer where he actually helps to educate doctors on the holistic approach to gut health and a lot of different complex digestive issues. Josh, I'm so excited to have you on. Welcome to Health Mystery Solved, Thyroid and Hashimoto's Revealed.
Ina, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to doing some Sherlock Holmesing.
Yes, me too.
Right.
So digestive issues are so common in those dealing with thyroid issues and Hashimoto's. And oftentimes it's like the chicken and the egg situation where Hashimoto's itself and hypothyroidism can lead to a lot of gut issues and a lot of different symptoms. And at the same time, the gut issues are often the triggers for Hashimoto's and other autoimmune disease as well. So why don't we first start by talking about the gut autoimmune connection?
Yeah. So interesting enough, the gut is one of the primary legs you'll have in almost any autoimmune condition. In fact, it'd be hard to argue that the gut wouldn't have some kind of issue. Primary reasons for that. Number one, we have to look at how your gut's connected to everything. So we know we often say like you are what you eat, really, but we are what we break down, digest, and absorb. And so your gut is responsible for breaking down things, digesting, and putting it to smaller pieces so that you're able to absorb it. And if you can't do that efficiently, you're going to have a problem, number one, just in keeping your body in what we call homeostasis, right? This nice median ground of what is considered kind of perfect way of being. And so we need all those nutrients. And it's interesting, if you think about it like having a sprained ankle, right? You can't walk as well, run as well, you're limping around, you're doing your best. But anybody who's maybe broken a leg or broken an ankle and hopped around, you know, after a few weeks, you get a little sore, right? The other side is compensating, your bones and joints start to shift. Same thing happens in your gut. When you start eating things or start lacking nutrients, right? Your body will start to compensate in other ways, and it can even draw nutrients away from important parts of the body. I know you guys are listening to audio only right now, but Ina can probably see even my teeth are a little bit on the yellow side. The lighting's not flattering. I got orange stuff around, but they're on the yellower side because I actually just found out I'm dealing with a candida issue, which has actually been leaching minerals from my body, and it will leach from areas like your teeth. And so that's why they're a little yellowier, is because that enamel has been leached away. I have to now rebuild that. So that's something that your body can start to do, is pull things away, which leaves weak links, which leaves you predisposed, for example, to other areas or other problems. If you get the flu and you already have maybe asthma due to whatever reason, it's going to attack your lungs pretty hard versus somebody who might have other problems. So that's number one. We have these weak links that can be created. Number two, our guts are the primary center for all of the production, growth, and maturation of most of our immune cells, right? 70%+, some will say 80-90% of our immune cells come from our gut, these B cells and T cells, and all these things happen there. And if you're compromised again, not only is there poor immune function or dysregulation in the immune system, right? But it can cause almost an inhibition in your body's ability to do what it wants to do. And I talk to my clients, I say, picture having company at your house, right? You can have company who's there and they're nice and chilled and relaxed and they're having a good time. Or you can have company who's a hostage and they're tied up and their mouth is taped, right? What makes better company? And so we're talking about the relation of the gut to the body. If you're compensating constantly, if you're having these weak links, if you're highly inflamed, you're going to become irritable and agitated. All these things become problematic. The body can't hang out with itself in that homeostasis and be comfortable. Things compensate, things happen. And so that's another way we start to see it. We also have to look at inflammation leads to leaks. We all know the term leaky gut, but most of us don't realize leaky gut is actually a good thing.
And in case that someone may be new to the show, may not be familiar, can you just explain what leaky gut is for someone who may not know?
Great stop point. Yes, I can. So leaky gut is exactly what it sounds like. Your small intestine and your large intestine are very, very thin. It's that small intestine, it's got one cell. When things pass through there and they pass into your blood, they can get to your lymphatic system, all kinds. It's kind of the in and out. Your large intestine is only two. And these cells are held together. Think of it like staples. They're called gap junctions. And they bind these cells together like bricks and mortar. And so what happens when somebody becomes inflamed is those cells start to open up. So instead of food and nutrients passing through the normal pathways, which would be exactly that. It would be through, say, the border crossing that's designated to come through. Things come through illegally and they come in and wreak havoc. So you get these macro molecules. They're too big. Your body doesn't know how to digest them because they've not been digested, broken down, and absorbed. They've been partially broken down and they force their way through these leaks or these holes in your border crossing. And now they're coming over wreaking havoc. Your body will say, hey, that's a large piece of chicken in my blood. It's not an amino acid. It's not the small thing I know how to use. That's actual chicken. So we've got a problem. And it sends a big signal down and says, hey man, intruder alert, you shouldn't be here. It puts a flag on that. And now that bumps up the immune reaction, the immune response. So your security team is on high alert and everybody's freaking out. And that's kind of what leaky gut does to the immune system. Things leak through when they shouldn't, where they shouldn't. But then it heightens the response of the immune system, causing everything to start looking like a problem. And the more elevated your immune system becomes, the more confused it can get, the more strapped the resources can become, so to speak. And that can lead to this autoimmunity. But leaky gut's a good thing when it's done in right amounts, right? And I can back up to that one really quickly, Ina, because it's really interesting to know that, for example, most of us have probably eaten something like Tim Hortons coffee. For those of you who are in Canada, I don't know if you have Tim Hortons in the US, I'll drink it and I'm in the bathroom in 5 minutes. My body hates it. There is something in there my body doesn't like. And so what it does is it actually opens the floodgates saying, we got to get you out of here. Like putting your thumb over the tip of a hose to hose down the driveway. And it opens up so the water can come in, flush things out of the digestive system and take care of it. That's leaky gut, but sustained, prolonged leaky gut. In areas it shouldn't be, in amounts, in length of time it should not be. That's what leads to this passage of large molecules into the blood, causing the immune system to go. So those are sort of our three legs of how gut causes immune problems.
Yeah, and that is very, very helpful. And I think it's so important for people to understand that because it is so connected. Now, in Beth's case, she was dealing with a lot of different digestive issues, from constipation to gas to bloating and distension and just a lot of discomfort and even some heartburn as well that would come from time to time. And so she went to her more conventional doctor. And in addition to being diagnosed with hypothyroidism and Hashimoto's, she had another diagnosis, which was IBS. Her doctor was pretty kind of general about it, as unfortunately that happens to a lot of people. And they'll say, well, this is what you have. There's nothing we can do, or go look it up and you could try to change your diet, but it just is what it is. And she, like so many people, were told you just have to learn to live with it and learn how to figure stuff out and change things, which is really unfortunate. And that's not, we don't have to learn how to live with it. We can actually support it. So if someone has this IBS diagnosis and they have a lot of these sort of overall kind of general GI issues, where is a good place to start, especially when they're not getting guidance and they're saying, just go to Google or figure it out or learn to live with it? Because we have a lot of tests, we have a lot of different types of protocols that we could do, but that also could be really overwhelming. So what is the first thing that would be helpful for people to do in these cases?
Yeah, I always start at the gut. And that's a good thing and a bad thing. You know, there's a paper by Dr. Alessio Fasano that's got a lot of popularity called All Diseases Begin in the Leaky Gut. And it talks about that leaking process we talked about where things pass through. And the problem is, as a clinician who specializes in Crohn's and colitis, if you give me a hammer for long enough, eventually everything looks like a nail. And so I can look at everything and go, oh, that's a gut, that's a gut, that's a gut problem. The truth is it may not be. And like you mentioned, chicken and the egg is a great way to look at it. So if someone had an issue, whether it was a nutrient issue or some other immunodeficit, maybe it was something in the body that caused this problem with the thyroid being the master regulator, right? I mean, we know the thyroid, it's in charge of metabolism, energy, cellular health, like mitochondria, ATP, that energy production. It's in charge of hair growth, nail growth, skin cell turnover, heart rate, blood pressure, mood, brain function, gut motility. So if the thyroid happened first, it can then cause this breakdown. On the other hand, we know that the gut, using a lot of the methods we just talked about, can lead to thyroid problems in a lot of different ways. And it sounds to me, I'm not a thyroid expert, which thank God you're here, Ina. What I used to understand is that most of our gut, or most of our thyroid rather, our inactive to active is actually converted between the gut and the liver. Now, it sounds like there's actually in some of the interstitial tissues and other places as well, which is fantastic. But even with the responsibility of the gut converting, right? The question is, do we truly have hypothyroidism? And as I'm sure you talked about on your show before, a lot of times we see people going in for blood work and the doctor will check the TSH, right? That thyroid stimulating hormone, which is a pituitary hormone, not a thyroid hormone. And it's your body says, well, hey, we don't have enough active thyroid. So let's just bump up production. Let's just give you more of it. And so what we end up happening is we measure this marker. Your body, your doctor will go, oh, look, it's high. Therefore, you don't have enough thyroid. So let's just give you a thyroid. You have hypothyroidism. Bing, bang, boom, that's it. Until they truly diagnose Hashimoto's, checking their antibodies and TPOs and all that. But people who might have, quote, low thyroid, is it just a conversion issue? Is it a production issue? Is it a nutrient issue, right? Where is the problem coming from? And unfortunately, most doctors don't actually check to see where the issue is originating. They just check the symptom and give a drug to mask that symptom. And so that's, of course, why you're here. Health mysteries solved. Let's get into the solution to the problem you're having. And so is it the chicken or the egg? If somebody came in with gut issues, we know it can cause thyroid. On the other hand, we know the thyroid can cause the gut. And so to answer your question, where do we start? My answer is, one, meet with a clinician who can help you do a very thorough history, right? In the same space of Crohn's and colitis that I work in, these diseases don't just happen. IBS doesn't just happen. Acid reflux doesn't just happen. Your body, if given the right conditions, will actually perfectly function. No question asked, right? We won't have yellowing teeth. We won't have skin issues. We won't have thyroid issues or bloat because it is functioning properly. It has the nutrients it needs and it's living in conditions where it can, you know, rest and digest effectively. And so we want to know a history, number one. Where did it come from? If it is in fact a gut issue, then what we want to do, number two, is figure out what might be disrupting the gut. Is there a history of long-term stress, which will cause acid reflux due to suppression of acid? In my practice, every case I see, without exception, to date so far has actually been low acid causing acid reflux. Is it a motility disorder? Is it a digestion breaking down disorder? Heavy doses of antibiotics? Are there mycotoxins, that's like mold and fungus, cause these toxins to build up in the body? What led to the problem? And then we can trace it back. Once you pull that linchpin, everything else can start coming down. And, you know, the health mystery is no longer a mystery because we found the root cause and your body heals itself and bing, bang, boom, it's been solved.
Absolutely. And there's so much on really looking at the root. And for most people, like you mentioned, it's probably more than one thing. So likely there is a thyroid issue that we want to support. And in some situations, supporting the thyroid can, you know, magically, if you will, right, shift the gut stuff. But in a lot of situations, there's going to be concurrent issues, right? So there may be Hashimoto's and there may be a true lack of thyroid hormone, which partly could be coming from the gut, but then if they have infections or they have issues with digesting, that's part too. So if someone has IBS and they are in the process of supporting their thyroid in the right way, but they also want to look at the gut, are there tests that you find helpful? And do you start with that? Or do you look at addressing diet first and then looking at testing? There's a lot of different ways. Of course, there's no right or wrong, but we'd love to hear your thoughts on that and we can chat about it.
This is a conversation I have with a lot of practitioners and some of the doctors I've worked with. You know, GI mapping is a test I really like to use. And again, for those who are listening and go, I don't have Crohn's or colitis, it's not about that. I look at these diseases as a severity spectrum. And I was actually just talking to Ina right before we started recording, where I look at these as sort of a wear and tear, where if you were to wear a pair of shoes without socks and go for a hike or a run, right? We all know what that blistering feeling feels like, that little bit of irritation, that redness, that blister that gets raw. And if it keeps going, you will bleed. And if the shoes are hard enough and the socks are not there, eventually you could work down to the bone if you decided to. And so that's what I look at as a severity spectrum for these diseases. It's accumulation. It starts small, just like this. It's a little bit of IBS. It's a little bit of what we call dysbiosis or bacterial imbalances. It's a little bit of infection, antibiotic usage. These things accumulate over time, piling up. It's filling your glass until it overflows. Now you have this disease process. On the other hand, I see a very acute onset. And again, this is the IBD, but some people might experience other symptoms like IBS or other mild gut-related symptoms. But that's something like mycotoxins, right? That mold toxin we talked about. The most common ones are these aflatoxins or ochratoxin A. We see them all over from walls and wet and plants and food and all kinds that can get in and cause these issues. Now, directly, it can irritate the immune system. It causes all kinds of problems. It causes local inflammation in the gut, inflaming the tissues, creating dysfunction. And it also creates a process we call pleomorphing. It's just a fancy Greek word or Greek root word that just means changing of the structures. And so what would look like a normal, healthy bacteria, all these levels are nice and even and playing in harmony. Suddenly, the entire ecosystem is shifted. And that inflammation, these quote, bad bacteria will say, they love inflammation, right? We know cancer loves inflammation. They love sugar. And so do these, quote, bad bacteria. I say, quote, bad because they all have a role to play. I'll say even the crack dealer at the gas station plays a role in the economy, right? In some way, shape, or form, they have a role in the neighborhood, good or bad, but under control, everything's in balance. It's fine. You have the police to watch things. And that's kind of how bacteria act. We have them in your gut, in your nose, on your face, orally, rectally, vaginally. They're in your hair, on your skin. But they're all these little neighborhoods that communicate. The second we become inflamed, they become disrupted. Once they are disrupted, they can no longer do their jobs properly. And this is where we see these big problems happening. And so for us, we want to figure out which tests do we need to do, right? Now, sometimes we can look at a GI map, which is a stool sample that measures all these bacteria or as many as we can see, right? In one quick snapshot. And the reason I had mentioned a lot of doctors, it's kind of a point of contention. One, many still don't know what they are. Even GI specialists won't know what a GI map is, and that's okay. Some doctors think they're kind of garbage tests. I've heard them called worthless. And the reason they say that, we have thousands of different strains, tens of thousands of different species multiplied out. I say it's about an average, about 20 million different bacterium, which totals 100 trillion inside of our guts. 2 to 3% of our entire body weight is just these gut bacteria, which is crazy. That's like 4 to 6 pounds for your average adult. And so a GI map really measures maybe 100 of these out of like 20 million. That's realistically what it does. And it counts how many of each one there are. And so a lot of doctors will say, well, they're useless because it's not definitive. We don't get enough information, but we have to keep in mind it's very actionable material. What we know about these is actionable. We can see different genus or strains of what you'd look at on the back of a probiotic bottle. You see lactobacillus, bifidobacterium, and their different strains. You'll see reuteri and acidophilus and rhamnosus. You'll see these on the back of a bottle. These are ones that we can actually measure. So at the very least, we can take some steps. And so they're some of the most studied bacteria we have. And so we know that we can actionably alter it with supplementation, for example, or certain foods. And so I am a big fan of GI mapping, but I won't say it's a complete tool by itself. So if somebody wants to measure, do I have gut issues or dysbiosis, get a GI map, right? It's not a fun experience to do. Have you ever had a GI map done, Ina?
Oh, I do it all the time.
Oh, good. So you know how horrible they already have to do.
Yeah.
So for the listeners, a GI map, I can mention, is a stool sample. I'm going to get a little graphic here. So basically what happens is they send you a kit in a little box and you start opening up. It kind of feels like Christmas. Like, oh yeah, I have all these cool things. And you open the box and there's, you know, vials and packages. And when you really actually analyze what's there, here's what you get. You get a pair of gloves, right? Non-sterile gloves that come in a package. You get a little cardboard tray that looks like something you get a hot dog in at like the ballpark.
It looks like a French fry container, right? That's what
it's a French fry. It is a little container with this like preserving red liquid in it with a little spoon inside. Once you put those pieces together, if you're listening, you haven't put the dots together yet, let me tell you. Last GI map I had to give, because you don't want to get anything on your clothes, I stripped down naked. I had to get into my bathtub and put this cardboard tray underneath myself to hope to God that he gave me the hand-eye coordination and dexterity to get my aim properly. Then you have to go in and scoop out little bits, a couple of spots, three or four, put them in this container, shake it, package it up, put it in the container. Now, the next step, if that's not enough for you, you now have to take it down to FedEx or wherever, look the person in the eye while you give them a box of your poop. So,
I don't know, listening to you, maybe I think about it differently, but to me, it's actually one of the easiest tests to do.
Oh, I'd rather give blood.
Really? Just because I have so many people who, you know, get anxious from blood work and, you know, all the things. I mean, and this is, you know, you could do it over the toilet too. You don't need the bathtub. So. You know what it is too? I also have little children. So, well, they're not so little, but you know, they're still kind of little. They're out of diapers now. But, you know, I think just, changing diapers all the time, it doesn't faze me at all. So.
Oh, you're a soldier. You know, I'm going to get myself one of those little toddler potties with like the little catch in the bottom. And maybe that's what I'll do my next sample.
That's what I do for my kids. I actually do. So, I mean, I do JMAPs on myself almost every year just because I think it's good to see the changes, especially if I'm doing certain things. But I did it on the kids too. I did it for both my kids when they were a year, which is an interesting experience only because with little kids, you know, they put everything in their mouth. So their bacterial load is actually very different than an adult. And I was trying to interpret it almost as an adult test. And it wasn't making any sense until I had to connect, wait a minute, like it's a completely different forming microbiome. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I digress. The point is that depending on how you think about poop, the test may be very easy or possibly might require a little bit. But, you know, as you said, there's gloves, there's a little thing, you don't have to touch it. And you can also call FedEx and then they come and pick it up from your doorstep so you don't have to take it. So that's another positive, I guess.
Yeah, so I'm not going to bring you my poop. You have to come get my poop. That's yes. So that's one of our tests, right? I mean, the other is we look at urine tests, like organic acid testing. We can look at mycotoxins, right? With that, you can another urine test as well, but some can be detected in the organic acid. So I think it's up to the practitioner to decide. Because I don't like when my clients have to spend a ton of money. I really don't. I think it's asinine. You can spend tens of thousands on testing, right? So do thorough histories. Figure out what's the most practical and pick one or two and go from there. If you do them well and do your history, that's pretty much all the information you need.
Yeah, no, I love that. You know, a lot of people come in saying they want to do food sensitivity testing and or they come in with like two different food sensitivity results. And I find that if there's a lot of imbalance in the gut, you're going to get a lot of really wacky results. And the food sensitivity testing is very expensive. And I'm not saying that I never do it or I want to deter someone from doing it, but I think it's helpful to do a few things and support the gut because if your gut is very leaky, you're just not going to get an accurate result for, you know, a very expensive test.
And the elimination diet is free. You know what I mean? So you can do the food sensitivity test and that's really, really quick, really easy. I don't really like the IgG ones. They're kind of wishy-washy based on what's going on, but there are a lot of really good food sensitivity tests and blood serum tests we can do. But like you said, they're very expensive. The only difference is you kind of pay for the convenience tax on that one because you get it, boom, it's done. Now you know, whereas the GI or the elimination diet rather, it takes a lot of discipline and consistency and due diligence. You have to track, you have to monitor and measure. And it's a lot of discipline to do properly. So it depends on the individual, but I like to tell my clients, because again, I don't like them spending money on stuff. And so my motto is that if you don't have the money, you do have the time somewhere. And so it's just, what do you want to spend? What kind of commodity do you want to spend on getting that answer?
Which is a great way to look at it. And for those who have digestive issues and they want to see what's going on and they're doing the GI map, what are some of the things that you feel are important to look at there?
So if we look at a GI map, for example, there's some really basic ones. There's all kinds of difference, but there's one really nice one I get. It's kind of what I call the Apple of GI maps. It's very user-friendly, kind of plug and play. It's easier to read if you know what you're looking at. And there's one from Diagnostic Solutions. There's a little lab in Georgia. And right away, they go through your pathogens. That's the first thing on top. Do you have your C. diffs, E. coli, Salmonella, Varicella? They'll do some virus testing, Epstein-Barr, basic, basic stuff. And we know, do I have it? Do I not? And just even those markers, this is where the nuances come in. Even though you show positive on one of these markers, it doesn't mean it's a problem. I have people coming in who test positive for C. diff, but they're not having C. diff symptoms. It shows presence, not action of these bacteria. So it's we don't want people to freak out when they see these markers. We scroll down to the next page, you'll see like an H. pylori measurement, and it gets into your commensal bacteria. Now, commensal, those are the good guys. Those are the ones you want in there, again, in normal levels. Because even the nicest neighborhood, if you remember the Truman Show, you know, his little neighborhood, they actually filmed that in a real town in Florida. And it's perfect and clean cut and neat and everything works great. But imagine they had 500 more people move into this little town, suddenly the whole town would cease to function. And that's what happens with these commensals. We have these really good quality bacteria in balance. We can see, are they high or are they low? So we want to measure that stuff because too low is bad, too high is bad. So we go down to the next page on this test and you'll see we call opportunistic bacteria. Right? These are the guys that when they have the opportunity to, they can begin to overgrow. And so it'll measure, again, they're all good, but they can be problematic in high levels and they can cause problems. So if there's elevations, that's a problem. Typically, we want them not really detectable. And so further down on this page, beyond the commensal, what did I say? The opportunistic commensal bacteria. I'm doing this from memory. I'm reading lab tests in my brain. You'll scroll down and you'll see some that are now autoimmune inflammatory related, either opportunistic or commensal. Because again, even your good bacteria or these ones that like to take advantage of bad situations like antibiotics, sickness, bad food, sugar, alcohol, they take advantage and take the opportunity to overgrow. And so even those good guys and bad guys, they're actually directly connected to autoimmune inflammatory conditions like your Crohn's and colitis or other diseases. And so if those are elevated, we want them down. Now, if we scroll down further on the page, we can actually measure things like parasites. Now, anybody who's done parasite testing knows it's not super accurate. They're very hard to actually detect in one go for a number of reasons. But further down the page, we can even see intestinal or digestive markers. So we can see, is there fat in your stool? If there's fat, like oil in your stool, you're not breaking it down. Directs us back to the liver. We can see something called elastase 1. So we can see like stool elastase or how well your pancreas is producing these enzymes to break things down. We can see if there's any undetectable blood in the stool, like things we can't see with the eye, we can detect. We can see different immune markers. Are you reacting poorly to gluten with an immunity marker? We can see your secretory IgA. Now we have different branches of the immune system. We use the acronym MADGE, M-A-D-G-E, and IgA. We all know these IgGs, right? These blood tests for food or IgEs and you know these allergic reactions. But IgA is a section of the immune system more directly responsible for mucosal surfaces. So think soft and squishy, right? Oral, rectal, vaginal, like those soft mucous surfaces. That's where we start to see these markers. We can see, is that inflamed? We can see what we call eosinophil activation protein, which is typically associated with allergies and other things as well. We can see calprotectin, which we see in IBD. So that's white blood cell activity. And so it's an immense amount of things that can be measured, which direct us back. Even something called beta-glucuronidase. If that's an enzyme produced in the gut, which can recirculate bile. Basically, it kind of binds onto these toxins. It can reabsorb into the system, go through the liver, back to the bile duct, back to the small intestine, back to the liver, and you recirculate estrogens and hormones and toxins. And so all these things can paint a picture, which can point us back to tell a story. Maybe parasites or liver flukes can cause this recirculation. Maybe there's too much overgrowth leading to this elevation in this enzyme. Maybe it's poor bile secretion. You might be having stones forming. So all these things can tell us a story that with a proper history and the right testing can point us to the direction to see if this is what your problem is.
And this is so, so helpful to know. And especially as we kind of go back to IBS, which has, you know, that very general type of name, right? Like, okay, your intestines are irritable, but what does that mean? And I think this is what's really, really important for people to understand is that there is always that underlying cause. And a lot of times it's more than one. And so, you know, what you explained so well with all the different things we look at, we can see then, right? Like, is it the bacteria that's causing the overgrowth, that's creating your gas, right? Is it that we're not digesting fat or that we don't have enough digestive enzymes in the first place? And I think, you know, when people have IBS and especially if they already have thyroid issues, you really want to look at all of these things. And I think it's so helpful to see that in addition to supporting the thyroid, because a lot of these, like a bacteria, like H. pylori, for example, right? That could be a trigger for Hashimoto's. So in some situations, someone may have symptoms. In other situations, they may not, but depending on how much of that bacteria is there, right? Perhaps that could be triggering. So it kind of goes back and forth. And I just think it's so helpful for people to see like that bigger picture of what you just explained and, you know, to what you mentioned too with some of the doctors saying that the tests are useless. And yes, I get it's not everything, but it's something that we do know. Otherwise, where are we, right? We're nowhere because it's like, well, it's nothing. but there's got to be a reason. There's always a reason.
I'd rather have something than nothing.
Yeah. Now, what are your thoughts on dealing with pathogens? Because typically on a GM app, and I know you do them all the time, I do them all the time as well, you know, there's very rarely a test that doesn't have any pathogens. I mean, some pathogens are more pathogenic, some are more opportunistic, but they're still considered pathogens, you know, overall, right? Now, granted, of course, you and I are both doing samples on people who are having issues, so it makes sense. I'm not just doing samples on random people off the street who don't have issues, so it makes sense we see something, but, you know, there's almost always something there. A lot of people wonder, okay, well, is it enough where I need to actually do something to eradicate it? And of course, there's different opinions, which I'd love to talk about. You know, how do you feel about using herbs or even maybe certain pharmaceuticals for these things versus, you know, the other side is, okay, well, maybe if there's a lot of overgrowth, we need to then just bring up the good guys. And can they then maybe offset that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I'm a big fan. We talked about how bacteria sort of police each other, and it stands true not only for keeping things in check, but recorrecting things, right? Your bacteria are also correctional officers. And so what they'll do is they'll come in. If you have overgrowth, we can selectively choose specific strains of probiotics. Now, it is true, if you guys have heard, that a lot of probiotics are dead, so to speak, where they don't actually make it through. They die in the stomach or the upper GI. They don't really get in. Plant seeds like grow like trees and grow fruit. All right, so look at bacteria. If we explain probiotics, prebiotics, and postbiotics, for instance, I look at these as fish in a fishbowl, right? Your probiotic are the fish. That's your living bacteria. The prebiotics are fish food. Postbiotics are fish poop. Now, in a healthy ecosystem like a pond or a fish tank that has other living organisms, that fish poop gets eaten. It gets used and turned into other things. And these postbiotics do the same in the body. We produce these short-chain fatty acids. We produce certain vitamins, B vitamins, vitamin K, certain things your body can utilize. But when we have these overgrowths, we have too much poop in the tank, it's not getting utilized, or there's other fish producing poop we can't use properly, and that creates toxins in the ecosystem, which of course get into your blood and circulate around your body. And so what we want to do is pick certain species to recorrect these overgrowths, some that can eat the poop, some that will eat the fish that are overgrown and slowly, you know, break those down. And so, for example, if I find somebody with, you know, changes or overgrowths in whatever it is, I can use Lactobacillus reuteri, for example. Someone who tests positive might have a SIBO issue that's related to like methane bacteria. We can use certain strains, one called Lactobacillus reuteri. That one has been shown in some instances to bring those down. Candida albicans. We all know what Candida is, that yeast overgrowth. Saccharomyces boulardii can be really good for that. It also happens to be a good binder for certain mold toxins. If we use things like certain Lactobacillus or Bifidobacterium strains, you talk about pathogens. I have people coming in, again, working in Crohn's and colitis all the time, who have recurrent C. diff, who have had C. diff, who took antibiotics and got the C. diff infection, which is very possibly deadly. We can use certain strains of Lactobacillus or Bifidobacterium strains while people are undergoing antibiotic treatment to either inhibit or prevent or reduce the risk of C. diff infections, for example. So they all have these roles to play. And even the bacteria, the probiotics that don't make it to the fish tank, the ones that kind of just die on the way through and get used up, they still produce this fish poop or these postbiotics at some point in their life cycle, and they can still have good benefits. They can still produce nutrients. They can still mediate or change some of the structure of your gut bacteria. And a lot of it actually acts as signaling molecules to the brain and nervous system, and as different chemical signals that transmit things back and forth to help tell your body what needs doing. And so no matter what, they're always very beneficial when selectively chosen. The problem I see is people popping probiotics without realizing, again, we have 100 trillion of them, 20-ish million different strains and species and genetics. In fact, we've got the entire human genome has about 23,000 genes. We have about 3 million genes estimated inside of our gut bacteria. So that is 130 times more genetic material inside of our gut. And we just randomly start popping probiotics. And so it's very important to understand that just popping them arbitrarily might actually cause more problems than good. You could be pouring gasoline on the fire without really recognizing and creating a problem for yourself. And so I do like GI mapping, even the very detailed GI mapping, where we don't just see the species umbrella, all the Lactobacillus, all the Bifidos, we can actually see individual strains, then we can take specific action toward those ones and see what might be driving that up and down. But ultimately, the truth is, we're still guessing most of the time. because we know nothing about the gut. It is a grain of sand on a beach, and we're still just learning more and more about it every single day. So what we have is actionable, but it's not perfect.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. But it's also really helpful about probiotics, because there are people who are like, oh yeah, I take probiotics, right? And it's like, okay, but what kind and what strains? And of course, with probiotics, they also really vary in strength, where, you know, there's some that you can get at a drugstore that, you know, have a million organisms, which isn't really going to do all that much, but people don't realize they think probiotic, or I'm eating yogurt, right? I'm getting probiotics. Well, you know, it's pasteurized and most of them are not really alive anymore, or not many.
Yep. Or it's full of sugar and it feeds the bad guys anyway, and it counteracts itself. It's like, you know, drinking a bottle of vodka, but taking milk thistle with it to clean your liver. Like, doesn't really kind of contradictory.
Right. Exactly. Now I want to talk about postbiotics a little bit more, because I think most people know about probiotics, or have heard about that. Prebiotics are also fairly popular. Postbiotics, you know, I think are talked about to some extent, but it's still a little bit newer in sort of the media. And I think a lot of people don't understand that as much. So I know that you explained that postbiotics are kind of like the poop from the fish, but how exactly is that helpful for the body? And what are some examples of postbiotics? Because typically, you know, if you go to the store, they're not labeled as a postbiotic. They would be labeled as something different. So how would people use them, and what would be the benefits?
Yeah, really great question. So postbiotics, a lot of them can be sort of difficult to come by. There's lots of different postbiotics. We have all kinds of stuff, like fatty acids, we have vitamins, we have all kinds of stuff, peptides and all kinds of things that do things for you in the body. They help buffer the immune system. Like I said, they're chemical transmitters or signals back and forth. And so we talk about postbiotics. You can consume, there's all kinds you can get. For example, we can get some in a bottle. One of the most accessible ones is butyrate. It comes in another form called tributyrin, which is very beneficial. We've actually seen studies where 4 to 6 grams a day can actually correct some gut imbalances, help immunomodulation, help balance inflammation, do all kinds of stuff. And so these postbiotics, a lot of them can be difficult to take as supplements or very expensive to take. Like butyrate is very accessible, and it's kind of the gold standard for short chain fatty acids is postbiotic, because it's so beneficial. Like I said, inflammation, immune system, gut dysbiosis, even tissue repair can help repair the gut lining itself, which can repair those leaks and all kinds. So postbiotics are one of those things that I would like to say, yes, it's beneficial. Absolutely. Right? There's so many benefits from them. Can you take them in supplements? It's hard to say, because again, we're just getting there. So my theory on it would be something like this. We know vitamin D is great. We know most of us don't get enough, right? We know most of us don't produce enough or imbalance of the good amounts of postbiotics we probably should, because so many of us have gut issues. 70-ish percent of Americans complain of gut issues weekly, which means there's something going on. So we can make the argument pretty concisely. Most of us don't produce enough, but what we don't know yet is, can we take too much? So we know we can take too much vitamin D. We know we can take too much copper. It can lead to like schizophrenia and all kinds of issues. And so the question is, can we take too much postbiotics? I don't know. So would it be probably as safe as taking a multivitamin? I'd imagine so, given the circumstances of modern life and modern people. But if you were to try to give them to somebody with a very healthy gut, with pearly white teeth, with good cognition, who has no skin issues, and their gut is extremely healthy, you might actually cause an imbalance. Right? It very much is one of those situations where if it's not broke, don't fix it. And sometimes we just try to add. And that's a lot of kind of westernized cultures. We're always, what's the supplement I can take? What's the pill I can take? We're looking to add things in long before we look to take things out. And so just like any functional medicine dispute, we want to get to the roots of some of these people's issues. The question is there something you should be taking out before there are things you are adding in? Because something had to stoke the fire. Something had to cause this problem to come up. And I look at it like going to the hospital. I use this analogy. If you go with a thorn in your hand and it's all bloody and swollen and it's infected, it's been there for 2 months, 3 months, and you go to your doctor and they want to give you ointment for the pain, you'd be a little pissed off. You'd be irritated. Like, pull the thorn out and look at the same supplementation. What is your thorn causing the inhibition leading to the problem that you're trying to supplement? Start there and then supplement as needed. It's also cheaper.
That is a very good point. And speaking of thorns, and obviously we have a lot of different bacteria and these imbalances in the gut that we could see in a GI map that can be our thorn. But what about food? Let's talk about that, because I know that's a huge area that you talk about and I talk about as well. And I think that And especially in the more like functional medicine space, like you said, I think people love the idea of supplements because it's easy and because there's so many things. And unfortunately, I think some things, you know, might overclaim, and that's a whole other thing, right? But you hear things even on social media, oh, take this, it's magic for XYZ or ABC, right? And we think, okay, we'll just do all these things. And I can't tell you how often people come in, you know, to my office or even through my programs, and they have a bag of 30 different supplements. They're like, oh, I got this from this doctor. I got this from the internet. I started taking this. And, you know, and like you said, right? Like, how do we even know? And sometimes even if the test shows that you need all these things, if you need 30 things, right? Is there something else going on, right? As to why you need 30 things, which, you know, I think kind of goes back to, well, what's the diet? What are we putting in and how are we absorbing it?
Yeah, well, I look at it like, imagine you have a squeak in your car. You just go to the mechanic and randomly start replacing parts without getting it assessed until you hopefully maybe get lucky and fix a squeak. And now you've replaced 30 parts. You got a bag of supplements. And I look at the same way. If you can find the one thing, it might be one, two, or three supplements. It's not uncommon for me to recommend 10 supplements in a single phase for a client, but they are deliberate. It's the challenges when people are on things basically forever, and they're maybe not getting better or not seeing results, but they're told to be taking them. If I give a client 9 or 10 supplements for a single phase, it's because they are deliberately doing something. I recommend a specific amount for a specific amount of time to reach a certain phase of health where you can move on and build layers, like building a house, get your foundation under you. And that's what we'll do. But you know, as far as supplements go, specificity is key. Second to that, you asked about nutrition. I'm a nutritionist. I'm a holistic nutritionist by designation, and I hate talking about food. I really do. I don't tell you why, because there's so much mania around it. I personally do very well on a heavy animal-based diet. I'm keto, not by design, by happenstance. I eat a lot of red meat and my body loves it. I do very well. I know people who eat more plant-based and they do really well. Plants hurt my gut. I did not feel good. It messed up my bacteria. I also, going back in history, suspected I had this candida issue since I was like 15, underlying the entire time, never detected until I detected it, you know, testing myself, and things became a problem. So I noticed it. And so obviously plants, because candida loves fibers and starches and carbs and sugars. So plant-based material are going to be harder for me to digest. And so going through animal-based just simply starves a lot of those bacteria. And so I think for me, always, I will tell people, packaged, frozen, processed, any of that, always bad. There's this trend going on right now in social media about food elitism. Shut up. I just think it's such a stupid argument. It's like, if you're an English teacher, do you stop teaching people grammar because it's grammar elitism? Like, it's just always strive to be better. Just, you know, try. But I understand there are very real concerns about finances, and that can be cost prohibitive. And that's understandable. But for the other round of people who are interested in learning, you have the tools. It's not elitism. So treat yourself to real foods, because that's what your body knows how to use. Most of these foods correlate directly with most of these diseases. These diseases didn't exist either at all or in the amounts that we currently see. And it correlates directly to the rise of these artificial foods and ingredients and vegetable oils and all that junk. So I'm always against those things. Sugar, alcohol, gluten, I also remove as much as possible. Natural sugars, like raspberries. I love low sugar berries. Again, I'm not keto by design. I'll eat any berries, but for me, it's got to be organic because they are so pesticide laden. On the other hand, I don't buy everything organic. I'll buy my meat organic or berries organic. Some veg I won't bother. Pineapples, carrots, you know, it's up to you. If you can afford it, go for it. It's going to be better for you. But you can also go to the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org, and they have a list called the Dirty Dozen and one called the Clean 15. And the Dirty Dozen are the 12 most pesticide-laden, sickening, make you sick, destroy your gut foods every year. Blueberries, strawberries, spinach, apples, those types. The Clean 15 are the 15 you don't got to worry about. That's your mangoes, that's your carrots, your root vegetables, avocados, those things that are less prone to having pesticides. And so for me, I actually went back. I got asked this question before. So I went back and I figured out I created 21 different types of diets for my clients over the years. High carb, low carb, high FODMAP, low FODMAP, lots of red meat, low red meat, high protein, lower protein, all kinds of things to test out under different circumstances based on bacterial profiles and combination, not only what the data shows through their testing, but what do they feel? If I give you plants, they don't agree with me very well for a lot of reasons. Again, is it the plants themselves? right? Like Paul Saladino, Carnivore MD, right? He's got this video that went viral recently because broccoli is bullshit. Here's why. He's like, this is why it's bad for you. But then guys like Lane Norton are like, here's a randomized control. They gave them broccoli. It was fine. Everyone's different. Is it the broccoli itself? Is it the way it's grown, right? Is it the pesticides, the herbicides, fungicides, and glyphosate, or is it the plant? Who knows? And so I say, eat what feels good, provided it's something your great, great, great grandmother would recognize as an edible substance.
I love that.
Kind of as simple as it gets.
Yeah, no. And this is really something, and I agree with you so much on that, and especially the part that we are all different. And I think with all of the different controversies on all of the things, you know, food related right now, I think that's what's forgotten is we're all different. Like, how can we say that being vegan is good for everyone, or eating a lot of animal protein is good for everyone? Depends on our metabolic type. It depends on our genetics, on so many different things. So I love what you say about really listening to your body and really being in tune. You know, and I think with that too, there's different times in your life, right? As you mentioned, you're dealing with candida now. So even more so, we want to be conscious about the amount of sugars and starches that are coming in versus once that's eradicated, you know, you might be able to better tolerate certain things. Not to say that your body ever wants to have a lot of starches, right? But maybe during a winter where it's really cold, you know, things might be a little different than the summer too. So I really, really love that. And I think that this is so helpful to the people listening, because it's that like permission granted to listen to your body. Because so often, right, it's like, do this and only this. And if you don't do this, you're going to die, right? I mean, that's kind of the message that we are given. And
but it's clickbait, right? It's exciting. Oh my God, it's changing everything. It's a paradigm shift. One of the first things they teach in social media marketing is challenge beliefs, shift paradigms, and break social norms. And that's what creates clicks, which drives revenue, which drives this dichotomy of messaging of lefts and rights, not politics per se, but even the politics of the diet industry. It's so dramatic. But yeah, eat broccoli, you're going to die. Like, excuse me? No, I'll probably be fine. I might get a little bloated. I don't digest broccoli. It comes out like it comes in. I can see the broccoli florets. So I don't eat it. It irritates my gut. People can break it down. But I think, Ina, the only way we'd really know, really, to study the differences between people is take massive amounts of populations from people who are as least affected by the toxic world as we can, right? We know most of the ocean is going to be polluted with some kind of heavy metals and toxins. There's oil spills, and we dump pharmaceuticals and mercury and all kinds of junk into the water. It's horribly toxic. In fact, there was a study from the Red Cross, again, published by, I believe it was the Environmental Working Group back in 2004. And they found 287 chemicals inside these 10 freshly cut umbilical cords on average per baby, 287, known to cause birth defects and cancers and all kinds of issues. So we're all highly toxic. And so there's actually an island called North Sentinel Island. It's off the Bay of Bengal, right? And it's just outside of this called Nicobar Islands territory of India. And the Sentinelese people, you can't go there. It's actually protected. The Navy, all these things actually stay so far away from this island that nobody can get in. They've actually had visitors try to come up in boats, and they shoot them with arrows and they kill them, right? They're white demons and whatever, because they're still literally like ancient tribal people on this island who have never seen another visitor of another skin color. Airplanes are gods and aliens to them still. And so the only way I think we'd really know if you could get there without getting shot in the chest with an arrow would be to see, what do these people eat? There's only a couple hundred of them, I think, on the island, maybe less, maybe a few dozen. I'm not exactly sure the number, but it's quite a small population. So what do they eat? How do their bodies fare? Go down to these Amazonian tribes, go to the jungles, go to the pygmy people, go to, you know, tribes in Tanzania and rural areas of like Nigeria. And there was actually a study, interesting, that I just talked about it in a podcast episode recently, and they actually took GI maps, tested microbiomes in growing city centers, and they took them, compared them to rural Nigerians, like farmers living off the land, barefoot in the grass and getting outside, and then even compared that data to westernized cultures, who are these big metropolis cities, and they actually found the diversity. So we know the diversity, like you mentioned, between babies and adults is quite extreme. Like a growing microbiome just still breastfeeding is very different from adults. And we think, well, okay, it must be our guts change over time. But they actually found that testing infant stool and adult stool was less different in these larger cities of Nigeria. It was almost identical in infants and adults in rural Nigeria living off the land, barefoot in the grass, interacting with the animals, being outside. And so that's some data we can look at to say, okay, clearly Western culture, we're great at destroying our gut bacteria. but amazing, our bodies are so good at compensating. But it also explains why we have all these diseases and sicknesses they don't, why we have elderly rotting in nursing homes and they have elders in the tribe still hunting at 80 years old. It's a very different aging and sickness process. And so that's data that interests me. The data we have here, even blood labs, it's all based on a population where 90 to 95% of people are not metabolically healthy. We're all sick. And we're using this as data to say, here's what's normal. But we know normal is not optimal. So what good is it? And so we have a very small populace of people left on Earth, some we can't even access, that could give us some of this data we could look at and say, what is optimal for humans? What should we be eating? But then you got to go, okay, well, here's where they were born and raised. Is it a genetic thing? Is it a racial thing? Is it a, this is an evolution thing? Who knows? So we'll just never know. So just eat and figure it out. Keep a journal, man. That's all we can do. And you'll beat millions of years of research.
Yeah. Well, and like you said, it should be a food that your great, great grandmother could recognize. You know, I think getting back to natural things, and I know that sounds really simple, but it doesn't have to be complicated, right? Like, I think we overcomplicate so many different things. And so it's getting back to simple and really listening to your body. And, you know, it's great that we have some of the testing, like the GI maps and, you know, other tests like that, where we can see things. And then thankfully, you know, as you explained, we can then go after the things, we can eradicate them with certain herbs, and then we can combat and balance it with certain probiotics, and knowing the types of strains, like Akkermansia, for example, there's so many people who just don't have it. And, you know, we don't know, right? What was it lost? Which generation it was lost in? Because I'm sure it was probably there at some point. We don't know, right? But, you know, seeing that can be really helpful, because then we can customize things a little bit more, which is super helpful.
Well, I think that's where this comes from. I mean, we know in these studies, a lot of our fiber digesting enzymes or bacteria have been broken down. We can see that comparison. There's more fiber digesters in rural Nigeria than metropolis cities in USA. So maybe this is why carnivore works so well for us over here. But then again, a lot of these tribes do eat carnivore. They'll literally kill a goat, eat a raw kidney. So, I mean, yeah, it's, who's to say? My thought is just eat it, try an elimination, keep a log, and you will compile hundreds of years worth of data, millions of years worth of information from evolution, and have it within your hands in about a month.
Yeah, that's so helpful. And keeping that log is also something that I think people underestimate. They think, oh, yeah, I'll remember. No, you probably won't remember. And why should you have to remember, right, when you can keep that log? And that could be a food log, but also even just, you know, with that, like all the symptoms, you know, I talk to women about that also, like with their menstrual cycle and other things. Like, it's so helpful to see, because that's how you really become your own health advocate, right? You can go back and you can see, and then no one can tell you this food is bad for you if you actually, and again, within reason, of course, I'm not saying like a French fry, but like if it's a natural food that comes from the earth, if you feel well with it, there's got to be a reason for that and go with it, versus like you mentioned broccoli, like, you know, there's no reason at all that you should force yourself to eat broccoli right now.
Go with your gut. Quite literally, go with your gut.
Yeah.
I agree.
I love that. Oh, Josh, well, thank you so much for being here. Such helpful information. And for people who want to connect with you, who want to learn about you, where can they find more information?
Well, it depends what they want to learn about, but the main hub they can reach me at is gutsolution.ca. I am in Canada, but I do, of course, work all over the world, as most of us online practitioners do now. Thankfully, my good insurance policy covers that. But I have a podcast called Reversible. That's Reverse Able, the ultimate gut health podcast. And that podcast, it's all things gut related. It's how does our gut affect our world? How does our world affect our gut? You're actually going to be on the show meeting with us, I believe, in a couple of weeks here coming up. And so we talk about all these different conditions and their connections and their roles. But even the podcast can be found at gutsolution.ca. There's contact forms for questions. There's even free programs that I put out there for people who want to get help. Just kind of scratch the surface and dig in. So all that can be found at gutsolution.ca, and you can reach me from there.
That's wonderful. Well, so nice to connect with you.
Likewise. We'll see you soon.
As you just heard, the gut is so integral in autoimmunity, and Hashimoto's can be triggered by issues in the gut, while at the same time, gut issues can stem from Hashimoto's and hypothyroidism itself. This is why with Beth, and really all of the members inside my Thyroid Mystery Solved program, we look at it all together at the same time. With Beth, we started by identifying her thyroid type. This is the first thing that all of the members in my program get, because supporting your thyroid without knowing your type is literally like trying to shoot at a target in complete darkness. It's pretty much impossible. Your thyroid type is honestly one of the biggest keys so that you can support your thyroid. And you need to know that. And people in my program get this within the first few hours. Now, Beth found out her type, and then a whole world opens up at this point, because then we're able to really have a customized plan. Beth was the low T3 type, where her body was not converting her T4, a thyroid hormone that is less active, to T3, which is the most active thyroid hormone. So this is what goes to help your metabolism, your energy, your digestion, your brain health, and all of the other things. It was not surprising that she was having GI issues. As well, it was not surprising that this was her type, because one of the places where T4 actually converts to T3 is in the gut. So when things are off there, the conversion will also be affected. Beth got specific and personalized instruction on the step-by-step T3 support. And by the way, it's not always with medication. There's a lot of different things of what we do and how we support that. And then at the same time, we started to work on her triggers for Hashimoto's. Since she was having digestive issues, we delved into the GI triggers in great detail. Did you know that there are over 20 types of gut triggers? And so through various assessments, we figured out hers, and then Beth followed a customized regimen to address them. While she had many triggers, the cool thing is that so often the triggers will be connected, at least somewhat. And so it didn't mean that she had to do 20 different protocols. Things that we did to knock out one trigger actually helped several others. So it doesn't have to take nearly as long as she thought, or as we think that it would. In fact, after making the appropriate diet changes and working on properly breaking down her food, Beth saw a reduction in gas and bloating, as well as an improvement in her bowels. So often people think that they have both constipation and diarrhea based on their symptoms, but a lot of the time, it's the constipation that's really the main issue. And then the diarrhea just happens every so often because it's the body's way of kind of moving everything out that it couldn't move out. And so that is what we worked on supporting. Beth finished all of her protocols in about 3.5 months. And wow, what a difference. She lost 10 pounds, and she also lost the bloat, the constipation, and that constant GI discomfort. And the other cool thing is she felt so empowered because she actually now understood how everything worked together and where her issue lied and exactly what was happening. Really being her own health advocate made such difference. If Beth sounds like someone you know, can you please share this episode with them? And please be sure that you're subscribed to the show so that you never miss another thyroid mystery. Thank you so much for listening. I am so happy that you're here, and I want you to remember that no matter what you're dealing with and whatever is happening with your thyroid or your immune system, the answers are there and there is hope. I'm Ina Toppler, and I will see you on the next episode of Thyroid Mystery Solved, Hashimoto's and Hypothyroidism Revealed. Bye for now.
All information, content, and material on this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to serve as a substitute for the consultation, diagnosis, and/or medical treatment of a qualified physician or healthcare provider.